Hi, this is Mandy Griffin.
And I'm Katie Swalwell.
And welcome to Our Dirty Laundry.
Stories of white ladies making a mess of things.
And how we need to clean up our act.
Hi again.
Hello. We're doing
it. We're back for our second interview, like we said we would.
It's happening. Oh, gosh. I keep thinking the universe is like sending messages that it is time for us to be back at this really intentionally, because so much is happening right now around the weaponization of white mothers. Like, don't you feel like the universe is just screaming, you know, this, it needs our attention, that not ours, like you and my, like, yeah, sure, right, right. us, but like in general,
but
white
our people.
Mothers, our people are being weaponized and they're being summoned by very dark forces. And we don't want that to be what happens. We cannot let history repeat itself. And we will definitely get into trad wives, like everything. Yeah, there's just so much happening right now. And this season, you know, we've been thinking about doing it for so long. And this conversation that we're introducing today with Debbie took place so long ago, but it does seem like things are really heating up and coming to ahead around this issue of white motherhood being a really toxic, horrifying, terrible legacy of upholding white supremacy, capitalism, Christian nationalism, patriarchy, heteronormativity, like you name it, ableism, all of it. So I feel like very, very fired up. And in revisiting this conversation with Debbie, in some ways it made me sad. One of the last questions we ask her is like, what is her dream issue she hopes to be working on in a decade? And I thought, gosh, even in the time we've talked to her in those intervening months, things have just definitely gone the wrong direction. They're not going the way that we would hope to see them go when it comes to children's literature, which is our guest, Debbie Rees, an absolute just like, I don't want to put anybody on pedestal because that's sort of the point of our podcast is to get complicated. But her work has been
so... She also talks about that.
Like she does.
Being put on a pedestal during the interview. She talks about that. So,
So I won't do it here. I will just say I so appreciate her work. It has been foundational for so many educators' understandings of children's literature and problems with it around representation of Indigenous communities, children, people, nations, et cetera, and has been an activist, an organizer trying to draw attention to that, and has a blog that I think everyone should go to. So yeah, so I met Debbie when I was a professor of education and had known of her work, and we invited her to campus when I was a professor at Iowa State, and she gave this incredible talk, and then she and I were able to connect. Also, as mom, she has a daughter that she's incredibly proud of, and it just really clicked. And so I just appreciate her so much, again, just as a person and as a professional, just a really incredible person. That's not pedestal talk. That's just like you meet someone who you love, right, who you think is great. And none of us are perfect, of course, but she's wonderful. So she was raised at Nambe Awinge and is tribally enrolled there. She has been a classroom teacher. She talks about that. She's been a professor also. She's probably best known for her blog that I mentioned, the American Indians and Children's Literature blog, which we will link to in the show notes. And then she's also co-editor with Jean Mendoza of a Young People's Indigenous History of the United States, which is like a version adapted from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which everyone should read. And actually, I feel like we should see if she would be willing to come on and talk to us, because that book is really incredible and super helpful. So Debbie has this great blog. She is a writer. She edited this beautiful book. She's got a doctorate in education from University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and also a master's in library and information studies, which comes across in her love of children's literature and, you know, her desire to see that be better. So I think for us, segueing from the Moms for Liberty episode that you dug into with us and the continued panic and freak out and book challenges and book bans, this is a great listen for that. What would you
That's what I thought, like, just that our episode on Moms for Liberty, everybody, I think, knows them very well. And one of their big pushes being the whole book banning. And obviously, Debbie's focus is on books that represent Indigenous people, but all of the concepts apply to every other marginalized group. Just the importance of literature in being able to enter a world that you are not part of. For our, from our standpoint.
Respectfully and accurately and with care and concern. Yes. And when a book doesn't do that.
And the problems with that. But also the importance to that community to see themselves represented in literature as well. So just both of those ways of looking at why this literature is so important, I think comes across really well in our discussion with her. So too.
I hope people enjoyed it, and I hope everyone's inspired to advocate for these books and to advocate for better representations for both of those reasons.
And I think one of the things we talk about too, just to like give people a little bit of a I don't know, something to think about, something to listen for, is so one of the things we talk about is books that we grew up reading and loving and cherishing and as adults finding out that they were probably pretty terrible, and the ability to let go of our attachment to them and be able to see the harm that they may have caused and not just reflexively fight for our, you know, childhood thoughts about those books.
With any mascots, which Debbie talks about, same with media. I just pulled up a movie for my kids the other night that had like a, it was on Disney Plus, and it had one of those like warning things that popped up right away, like this film includes depictions that are offensive and demeaning. And so I was like, well, then we're not gonna watch it. Done. There's 18 million other things to watch. It was some old, you know, animated cartoon. Not to say that recent animated cartoons don't have their own problems, but thought, there's other stuff to watch. Like, I remember watching that movie and I have fond memories of it, but that does not mean that I want to repeat those same mistakes for my kids. So I appreciate you pointing that out. Great. Debbie's conversation is wonderful. I think everyone will really enjoy it, and check out her blog.
Yay. Thanks, guys.
We always like to know how you want to be introduced or what you want to have shared about you. So let's just start there. What would you want listeners to know about who you are?
Okay. Let's see. My name is, it kind of is. My name is Debbie Reese. I'm tribally enrolled at a small Native nation in what is currently the southwestern part of the United States, the state of currently known as the state of New Mexico. Debbie is my name. My mother and father named me Debbie when I was born. That's what it says on my birth certificate. When I went to the day school, which was part of the federal government's boarding school system, I had a white teacher. So we're talking like 1964. Mm-hmm. And that white teacher told my parents that they had named me wrong, that my name should be Deborah, that Debbie is a nickname. And so she would tell them that more than once. You know, they would come in for something and she would tell them. But they were like, nope, her name's Debbie. At the end of the year, I had the best grades. So I got, at that time, their teachers were giving out certificates of achievement based on like ranking, if you got how who had the best scores. Anyway, so I got first that year, and she wrote Deborah on my certificate.
And it begins. Here we go. Just right out the gate, Debbie. I love it.
Right out the gate. Yeah. Yeah. And that was a white woman from the East, and I didn't like her. I have great memories of liking school and learning to read and all of that. I enjoyed it, and I thrived in school. But I have memories like that of teachers trying to tell me this or that.
And then you became an educator yourself. Do you want to talk a little bit about your journey to being an educator and your role in supporting so many teachers and educators today, just being such an inspiration to me personally, but I think just knowing that you are like a go-to person for so many people who are wanting to educate kids.
Well, I was one of those people that pretended I was a teacher when I was in second grade. I made my little sisters be my students. So I was always interested in learning and educating. I think that's a place to start. I went to school undergraduate to get a teaching degree. I went to graduate school and got a master's in school administration because at the time I was teaching for a while and it seemed like, you know, things could run a little better. And so I thought I might be able to do that. And then I took these courses and I thought, I am never going to do that because that's a tough job. Mm-hmm. So I gained insight and a new respect for administrators and what they're doing or what they have to do. I have complete sympathy for administrators today who are trying to keep books on the shelf, and in the face of what's happening. I went to the University of Illinois and got a graduate degree there, a PhD there. We were forewarned that there was a mascot there, and I said, it's okay, it'll be fine. But I got there and I thought, that's when I first realized just how powerful image mm-hmm. is. Because there, people were like, they really love that mascot, and they really firmly believed that it was educating them about Native people. Mm. And I would say, no, it's not. This is a stereotype and it's not a good thing. Can we talk more? And it was like, no, they shut down the conversation. Mm-hmm. That was individuals, but it was also groups like Boy Scouts and people like that. When they hear that there's a Native person, like, you know, they like call you up and want you to come and dance for them. And I'm like, no. Our dance is a more of a spiritual or a religious thing. And it's not something I do as a performance. So no, I won't dance for you. Mm. Okay, will you come and tell us stories? And I said, no, I'm not a storyteller. I'm a teacher. I'd be glad to come and talk to you about Native people, my people, at Nambe Owinge. And they never wanted that. They wanted a performer or a dancer. And, because that's what they saw in the mascot. The mascot was entertaining them. They thought they were learning from that figure dancing at halftime. And they weren't. So that's when I moved to Illinois and started seeing just what a grip that had on so many people at a research one university. I thought, okay, what's going on here? And I had gone there to study family literacy because I wanted to work, to learn some things. I also learned a lot, learned so much. Anyway, what I was talking about, so mascots, trying to understand why people were so taken by them and still interested in books, I decided, well, what's in books? At the time, the University of Illinois had one of the largest collections of children's books in the country. Mm. And so I thought, okay, here's a source of information that I can study. So, that's what I started doing, was looking at picture books and noticing how many times the kinds of books that our parents give to us, our grandparents, our people who teachers, early childhood teachers read to us, books that we formed this association, an emotional association to Clifford the Big Red Dog and Grizzly Bob and the Berenstain Bears, all of that. And when you start looking at those books and you see some of the content in those books, you say, oh, that's why this mascot means so much to people, because Clifford the Big Red Dog was dressed as an Indian for Halloween, and Grizzly Bob had his arms raised and telling stories in the Berenstain Bears Go to Camp. So that's what I did. I started looking at children's books because of the significance and importance of storytelling on all of us, humanity, everyone around the world. Storytelling shapes how we be in the world. And so they matter. The stories matter, and who's telling them matters, and how they tell them and how they talk about others. All of that became what I do with my blog and looking and reading and showing others what I see. And I am glad that I did that. Part of what I did with the blog was that at the start of graduate school, I was like not able to, we're supposed to publish, you know, in certain places, and it was all behind paywalls. Mm. I had been a teacher. I couldn't afford to be a member of National Council of Teachers of English. So I had an article published there, but teachers couldn't read it. You know, teachers I worked with in New Mexico, where teaching doesn't pay well in New Mexico. So the blog was a way for me to try and get my research out to people who couldn't get beyond the paywalls or couldn't afford to buy the $120 book that has one of my chapters in it. So I could make it accessible.
Your comments you were just making about, you know, like stories kind of teaching us and showing us, different views, just reminded me of an article that I found when I was doing some research on you and looking through your blog. And there was an article that was published, I think it's the Southern Poverty Law Center in their Learning for Justice that you gave an interview and you talk about Native representation in books, and it kind of can be generalized, I think, to all sorts of other groups too, with the current atmosphere of book banning and everything. But you talk about books being, I think it was a quote from someone else, and you'll have to remind me if you remember, but they're a mirror, a window, or sliding doors into other experiences. Could you talk a little bit about that metaphor and like how you see that relating to representation?
Yeah, the metaphor came from Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop, who's an African-American woman who is retired from her position as a literacy professor at Ohio State University. I think it's the Ohio State University. Anyway, she's been a leading voice for anybody who studies children's books, particularly representation. So she came up with this metaphor in the 90s, and her writing on that was that books that reflect who we are, so we're looking at a reflective surface. So a mirror is a reflective surface. Mm-hmm. A window can be a reflective surface. A window can be lowered and you see into another space. So the idea that she was bringing forward was that if you see some image that looks like you, whether that's your gender or your identity as a Native or a person of color, that can be a mirror of your own experience. So that's how the mirrors part works. The window was that I can look, if a book is well done, these are all books that are well done. If a book is well done and it's about an African-American community, I can read that book and it provides me with a window into a culture or a space that I don't have access to just as a matter of my daily life. So that's the metaphor, and it comes from her, and it took off in like the 2000s, I think, and people were using it all over the place and not knowing where it came from. And there was recently, like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, there's a huge thing on Twitter because a white woman was using it and not attributing it to Dr. Bishop, and others said, you know, that comes from a certain place. Could you cite the place, the person it came from, because it's a woman of color? And it did not go well.
She was graciously accepted that feedback and then it quickly corrected. Is that what happened, Debbie? No?
I'm shocked. I was going to say, where did you see that?
No, I'm shocked.
I know. Oh. And she deleted her account and people were like, where did she go?
Oh, gosh.
Lord. Well, that metaphor, Mandy, I'm so glad you brought that up, because Debbie, I've heard you talk before about your addition to that metaphor in terms of curtains. Could you talk a little bit about how that adds to and provides some nuance for that metaphor?
Yeah. So probably 12 or 13 years ago, I was going to work with some librarians in Alaska. So I was doing a PowerPoint and developing my slides, looking for some slides to get to use for the metaphor. And I was looking for a window, because I was going to be hoping that what I was going to present was a window onto Pueblo people or Native people broadly. But Native people from my village in particular. So I was looking for a window, and so I was Googling all these terms, trying to find just the right window. And our community house, which is part of our kiva, which is a religious structure, kept coming up, and I'm like, no, not that. And then I realized why it was coming up. It has a window in it, but there's curtains on the window. And I'm like, well, I know why those are there, but it just clicked to me, like, all of a sudden, that is part of a metaphor, because we have things that happen that we don't want to share. And so we have curtains on our windows at the community house. So I started thinking about that as part of the metaphor, because historically we are taught not to share some of what we do, because there's a long history of government policy being created that harms us, because the policy is based on someone looking in the window, not understanding what was going on, and turning it into something else.
And when you say looking in the window, you mean literally, not even.
Yeah, I mean literally. I mean literally. Because what was going on in the late 1800s and the early 1900s is the federal government was really sure that we were about to die off completely. And so they were sending what we know what we call ethnographers. This was an emerging field of study. They were sending what was being called, what was came to be called ethnographers out into the reservations to gather our ways before we were all gone. And so all this money was spent sending these people out there, and they literally would like sneak into places, and people were saying, get out of here, you can't be here. But you know, they're bold. They were bold, and they were doing it anyway. And they were creating documents that now live in the museums that are seen as like the old authentic stories of Native people. And they're like, no, they're not. This is a white man's Indian. So there's that phrase that came into common use. The white man's Indian is something that a white person created that they didn't know what they were talking about. So there's lots of white man's Indian stories that writers of children's books think are authentic and reliable sources, and they're not. So there are lots of children's picture books that have that stuff. It was literally looking in the windows, coming into the spaces under sanction from the U.S. government.
That's always stuck with me so much, especially knowing how many children's book authors are white women in particular. Are there, I have so many questions about children's lit. Selfishly, as someone who reads a ton of children's books right now to my own children, and we will link to your blog in the show notes so people can go check it out. It's such a great resource to know what books to avoid or what to look for, what to pay attention to in books that are problematic and which books you recommend and think are really beautiful. What kind of response have you gotten to that blog? Like what do you hear from people about what you're trying to teach them?
Gratitude for the information that's there. A lot of teachers and librarians write to me saying, oh, I'm so glad I looked this up because I was about to use this book and now I see why I should not use this book. So I get that kind of email. I also get emails from teachers and librarians and parents who want to know if I have a chance to look at a certain book. And so a lot of what is there on the blog, and this is going back, where are we, like 15 years, maybe more. I started in 2006, is a lot of what's there is there because a teacher or an educator wrote to me asking for help. So I turn those questions over into posts on my blog because practitioners want the information. And I think if one isn't looking for it, another is too. I never disclose names or locations because there's a lot of fear too. There's a lot of backlash that people have to endure when they make a decision about what to or not to use in their classrooms. So I'm very mindful of that. I try to protect the individuals who are writing to me. I also know that lots of editors read it because they will, I hear from writers who said, oh gosh, I messed up so bad. But I can't say that publicly because my publisher said I can't say that because that would harm the publisher's reputation. So there's interesting, so we all know about these in non-disclosure kinds of things that people have to do, right? Sign whenever they're doing so much. And increasingly, that seems to be a thing. And so it does have an impact on what, so writers are learning. So basically what I'm saying is writers are reading it and they're learning and their editors are reading it and they're learning. But there's also this like silence. Let's not be too loud about, let's not talk about this too much. That will be bad for our bottom line. But I know in those cases that the writer is going to do something different next time. And that matters.
I had a couple of other quotes that you had brought up in that article that I had saved that I really wanted to kind of like delve more into a little bit. This is, I think they were asking you like, what's the push towards banning books? Like, what's the motivation for doing that sort of thing? And you had a couple of different answers that I liked. This thought that you brought up that you were saying in terms of population, we like as an Indigenous Native community are very few in comparison to others. But all children who, you know, may be exposed to these things have the opportunity to grow up and become policymakers or influence policy in some way. And you're saying if you read books where Native people are portrayed appropriately, then you develop an empathy for them and see them more as human beings. And then when you get that kind of a perspective, then that shapes your actions that you may take as an adult in these groups where you actually have some sort of influence. And then that's going to inform policy. That's going to inform laws. It's going to change the way that things operate. And I think the point is maybe that's where the fear comes from. There's a fear, and you say this in another part, there's a fear of justice almost, that people are afraid of things, of our world becoming more just, because when injustice and inequity benefits you, then it seems like when things become just, you lose something, which is a really messed up way to look at things.
Just to be clear.
Just to be real clear. But I thought that was so true. So, I mean, I think back on the books that I read, like as a young adult and, you know, teenager and an older adult, and how many, I mean, they say like books are like being able to travel from your own couch, you know, and get to see into worlds that you never would have before and get these perspectives you never would have had. And I think that is part of the fear. I don't know. Do you guys think that? I mean, to me, in the way I think about the world, I don't think we should ever be afraid of knowledge. But it seems like when in some of these communities that are trying to ban these books, they really are afraid of people seeing that, you know, other communities are just as valuable as their own, and that other belief systems are just as valid, other experiences have value in them too. Like, what do you think the fear is in people learning that?
Katie.
I'm living right now in a state where we did just pass a book ban. Iowa just went through, and it's specifically focused right now on gender and sexual identity, you know, sexual orientation, but it's very clearly, you know, it's not like, okay, good, we got that done. Now we can get back to the work of making policy that addresses real social like problems and, you know, climate change. No. It's part of a much larger plan. And when I think about the books that I've learned about through your blog, when I think about An Indigenous People's History of the U.S. for Young People as another example of just having been personally so important to my own learning and such a valuable resource when I was working with kids in classrooms, that to learn the stories, it isn't just about understanding the experiences of people who might be from a different community or have a different background. It's not just that. It's also bearing witness to and documenting and accounting for very, very real harms that have been done and are being done by the U.S. government, I think, just to name one. And I think for people that don't want kids to question authority, who don't want kids to question power structures, the acknowledgement of communities opens up other questions that lead to answers that undermine these power structures. And so it's why a book like Hair Love, that's about a little girl and her dad doing her hair, you know, that's a banned book, because once you start down these paths of learning about people and communities, that it just begets other questions that I think people don't want kids asking. Debbie, what would you I'll take it back to you.
Well, it kind of, I guess when I think about how people are responding and trying to have books pulled from the shelves, it's very much in line with what we saw when we were doing mascot work. And because I think it makes them feel guilty. It did make them feel guilty, I think, when they were willing to listen a little bit, but then didn't want to make any changes. They felt bad about that. And so it was better just not to have to deal with it at all. So I think that the bans are similar to that. It just, it's just, I don't want to deal with that. Let's just get rid of the books. If things were fine. But it's very centered on a white sense of a white being fine, a white existence being fine, without realizing just how bad it was, not just for Native people, but really for white people too, who are being miseducated about others in the world. Mm-hmm. It's not good for anybody. Our book is banned, and it's been boxed up in many places, and that's too bad, of course. One of the things I'm tracking around the banning stuff is how much we don't know about that process. And because people will say, oh, the book was banned, when a book was just challenged. And a challenge and a ban are two different things. You know, a challenge is a parent coming in or somebody coming in saying, I have a concern about this book. That's a challenge. And then when the organization or library says, okay, and makes a record of the challenge, and then they go to their committee and they decide, yeah, that book, we probably shouldn't have it on the shelf. That's a ban. Mm-hmm. So tracking what's happening there, people not understanding, it just makes it kind of a mess. It's kind of a mess. I would like more clarity on that when we're talking about books, on what's challenged and what's banned. The other thing that I'm noticing about the banning conversations overall, about the books that are ending up truly being banned or being challenged, are that Native books are not among them. Ours is, because it was on that Texas list, you know, a few years ago, of 800 books that a Texas legislator drew up. So ours is on that book, on that list. But there's a children's picture book called Charisse's Big Voice. Mm. It's by Charisse Davids, who's a congresswoman. She's a lesbian. The book has the word lesbian in it. She's Native. And in the book, she talks about how the United States government forced the Ho-Chunk people off of their land. And so there's a picture in that book of a soldier pointing his rifle at some Native people who are Ho-Chunk, which is her tribe. She hits all the notes that are getting reasons why books are being banned. The factual history of the United States, where the United States did remove people from their lands, Native people from their lands. What we're seeing in those banning movements is anything that threatens the idea that the United States is an exceptional, you know, place. Nobody wants that. Not nobody, but the banners don't want that. So they wouldn't want her book because of that page. They definitely wouldn't want her book because she's a lesbian, and she says it more than once. So why is that not on any of the lists? I think it's because we're so invisible. And that really hurts. That really, really hurts, because we've tried so hard for the last, forever. But now in the last 10 years, we just have so many books by Native writers coming out. They're not on the lists. They're not, because I think they're just not even, people just don't know about them. And that's not something to be happy about, because people should know about them.
You are promoting the banning of Charisse's Big Voice. Yes. You heard it here first, everyone. I hear that, though. Like, to say, well, in order to get challenged or banned, it has to be on people's radars enough in the first place. So it's an indicator that it's not, that is such a fantastic book. And it's an indicator then that it hasn't risen to the visibility of some of these other books. Yeah, I hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting to observe that what's happening with the what's banned and why and where and how. Mm-hmm. All of that.
The whole idea of banning books or banning the teaching of ideas that could make white kids feel bad or feel guilty is just it makes me feel so incredulous. Like, how do you not take a look at the other side of how the people feel that are being misrepresented or that are being mistreated or that have been abused or neglected or, you know, that are being represented in those stories? Like, you don't want your kid to feel bad, but what about the kids who are actually subjected to that? And that argument doesn't even get brought up is just so indicative of the focus, I think, of a lot of these legislatures and school boards and all of those bodies that just are so out of touch, I think.
Another thing that has come to my knowledge is how many curriculum packaging services there are out there and what they include. And so, like, the Moms for Liberty, that's like the most well-known
group of people that is trying to ban books. They went after a curriculum called Wit and Wisdom, I think is what it is. And you can watch their videos. I have watched many of their videos online. They have PowerPoint presentations and all this that you...
God, I hope you took care of yourself in some way after, because that sounds miserable.
It is because one of the books that they want to ban is a Johnny Appleseed book, because in this Johnny Appleseed book, that Stephen Kellogg's Johnny Appleseed, so it's old, it has some of the most ugly stereotypes of Native people in it. And Johnny Appleseed is the hero because the white people, the farmers and the Indians are like mad at each other because this is Native land and these farmers are there. And Johnny's like standing between the two groups trying to make peace. And so it just puts me like, how do I say this to people? Like, nobody should be using that book anyway. Because
again, you heard it here first. Debbie Reese supports Moms for Liberty. That's what I'm getting from this conversation.
I know. So that's my struggle, is how do I bring forward these legitimate issues with a curriculum that I now know about because of Moms for Liberty? Yeah. In ways that don't put a big censor tag on my work, because, you know, I try to put forth the idea that we're trying to educate children, and this is miseducation of children when you're using this book. It's not the same thing as the censoring that's happening with all of these other books. I have to write an argument so that I can say all of that.
Well, let's
and Katie's going to tell me how.
Oh my gosh. Wow. We can.
Katie, I was going to ask you if you think that Moms for Literacy, is that what they're
Liberty.
Called?
Liberty.
Liberty. Liberty. Not patriotism. Literacy. Anti-literacy. Moms for Liberty. Yeah. Like, is this just a rebranding of Daughters of the Confederacy? Yeah. Did they just change their names?
I don't know that it was like a one-for-one swap out, but that same exact group of people, driven by the same motives. There's something. But let's talk about that a little bit, because I don't think our society is known for our ability to be nuanced in our arguments and understandings of the world. That is, to me, one reason why we have to do a better job educating young people, to not replicate that level of like, it's either this or that. And then, you know, they have to be pitted against each other and there's two sides and that's it. But one of the ways I see that playing out is this idea of like challenging books and banning them because they are more accurate, more inclusive, questioning the status quo kinds of books versus what you do on your website. You know, I've seen you have like red circles with the line, you know, like the literally like the cancel sign saying like, this is not a book to read without like serious unpacking. Like, I think some of the worst offenders we would never want to do anything with. I can imagine some critical media literacy activities using some of the other books in really thoughtful ways. But, you know, you literally do say like, you know, Red X this book. So that to me is really different than the kind of challenge and bans that are happening. But I think it gets weaponized by people who want to just see it as like, well, you do it too. So what, you know,
it's disingenuous.
It's all the same. Right. So help listeners disentangle that, you know, like, how do you think about the distinction between like fascist book bans and culturally sensitive requests to not perpetuate stereotypes? Like, there's a difference there.
Yeah, that's why I wanted you to tell me how to say it. because here's the fact. Because a lot of what we're finding, what we're seeing happening around us is the soundbite. Mm-hmm. So we need a soundbite for this that will do the work that we need it to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the soundbite because it takes so many words to say that. And that's why that Red X works so well. Yeah. Because a Red X, you know, everybody knows what that means. It's a visual rocket right into your brain that's going to stay there forever. And I can say all these words and all these words and all these words, but those have to go through your ears and then they have to get processed and they don't go like that red rocket into your brain. So we need some words that can be like a sound bite for that.
Okay, let's try out this metaphor. I love to think of metaphors. So let's try this out. Mm-hmm. So how I'm thinking about it right now, test audience, is the book Banning, let's start with Debbie's Red X, right? To me, that is like a signifier that this food is not edible. Like this food will make you sick, right? And that is helpful information to have because I want to eat healthy food. The book ban folks are saying we can't have, you know, Indian food at this restaurant because we don't like the way it smells. And so it's a perfectly edible, delicious food that is nutritious and healthy. You just don't like it. And that's your problem. So maybe there's something there to help people understand that, like someone saying you shouldn't eat this food because they don't like it and they don't think other people should eat it, but it is actually like nutritious, delicious food that people should have access to and is actually super special and important to different communities of people is not the same thing as you pointing out that it's actually like garbage. The writer David Sedaris had this quote from years ago that I heard him say, Mandy, I'm sure I've mentioned it before on this podcast, mm-hmm. but he was talking about one of the presidential elections. And he was like, you know, the choice is so obvious to me. And I don't understand people who are undecided because it's as if a flight attendant is saying, would you like the chicken or the shit with shards of glass in it? And then you say, how is the chicken prepared? You know, like you're actually weighing the options. So to me, that's the distinction is like you're letting us know what will make us sick. And they're keeping us from experiencing like a smorgasbord of delicious food.
Yeah.
Maybe it needs workshopping.
I think that's good.
That's what I got.
To make it concise,
I know.
But no, it does make sense. I mean, we've talked about this about numerous other things before. When people try to pit one thing against another and saying just like, well, the extreme fascism, Trumpism, MAGA thing is just as bad as AOC on the left, and it's like, no. No. This is not the same. You can't just take two things that are different and call them the opposites just because you don't agree with one of them. But yeah, putting it into something.
Okay, I'll keep workshopping.
Yeah, we got to work on that.
Well, okay. So one thing I've been dying to ask Debbie about too is, and maybe this, Mandy, kind of goes to your question, like what motivates people so strongly? So one of, you know, I do think it really is like a fear of questioning the status quo because it might reveal things and inspire people to change and folks don't want that. But I think there's another big piece. And Debbie, your stories about the mascots and how people felt about them. I think there is, especially for white people, emotions, really, really intense emotions around nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And like my nostalgia trumps your need for better representation, you know, like that it's like a zero sum game. And the story that I know, I'm hoping you're willing to talk about a little bit, because I think it is just so powerful, is your work around the Laura Ingalls Wilder books and the especially white women's response to having those questioned in any way, and the award that was named for her that you worked to help get the name changed. I'm sure you have a million other examples, but that is one that is a series of books I read growing up and loved as a child and remember wishing that I could buy bolts of calico and make a dress out of, you know, that it was this very romanticized, like deep nostalgia. And yet for some people who hear your critiques, you have a choice. You can be horrified and say, yeah, I can let go of that nostalgia. There are other books we can read. There are other things we can do. But for some people, it's too much. Like that nostalgia is too deep. So can you talk to us a little bit about your experience helping people let go of that or like you know, the people that cling to it so tightly?
Oh, that's a big one. Yeah. When to connect the the mascot stuff and the Laura Ingalls Wilder name change to the award that was named for her. When I heard that they were, that ALA was having that conversation, that they wanted to change that award name, I was really flippant. I was really sarcastic to the people who were bringing it forth. I'm like, ha, good luck with that. Because I knew my experience with trying to, being in the room with very powerful people who were supporters of the mascot. And I mean, like the board of trustees of the University of Illinois. I knew that some people are just never going to go there with you. And so I thought that was a nice idea, but a foolish one, that because the mascot was so hard to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And the Wilder name, I thought, you know, those books and that person is just an impossible idea that you could change that award name. But they did it. They formed a task force and they moved very quickly. And that summer for ALA, I went to the conference and went to the room where the task force was going to present their findings. And I walked into the room and there was a big table and, you know, like a horseshoe kind of thing. And around the table were all white women, or women that that to my eye looked like they were white women. Maybe some were not. Mm-hmm. But I thought, forget it. You know, these are the ones that are going to vote. And no matter what that task force reports are like, I know who these people are. I've talked to many of them. But they did take the vote and they decided to get rid of it. I was stunned. I was very surprised. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And then it became a big thing online, of course, because William Shatner didn't like it and all kinds of things were going on.
God forbid. In that case.
Turn it around.
Yep, William Shatner. So it part of the conversations that I'd had with librarians and teachers about that book was I would say, can you actually read, think yeah. about my little girl okay. sitting beside you. Can you read that passage aloud with my little girl sitting right there beside you? And they said yes. And in the back of my mind, I thought, I hope you're lying to me. But they said yes. And they would argue, well, that's what they thought back then. So that's a very popular thing that people say to defend something like that. Well, that's what they thought back then. It's true to that time period. And I say to people about that, actually, people say that now. People speak that way now. And I point right to that former president and the things that he said about people coming over the border and they were savage rapists and all this kind of stuff that we heard from that person and from people who felt emboldened to speak because he said those things. So this idea that, oh, that's a product of his time. Or her time, that doesn't hold any water because people still speak that way today. I'm not sure I'm saying that very well
yeah,
or not.
You are. Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
trying to help people see, especially white liberals who are really prone to say, well, that's something that was written in the 50s. Of course, they said that back then. Nobody would say that now. And I say, come on, let's go look at what people are saying right now. Mm-hmm. And then I think that helps if we can look at speech of today. And as alongside speech of the past, they're the same speech. It's the same thing. So I think being able to show examples is helpful to people letting go of that nostalgic defense of a book as being a product of its time. That's a weird thing to say, too, though, because it says, I mean, it says like some people will take that as a, so that racist president is actually a good thing because it helps us understand racism. People twist things in such weird, weird ways.
I had another question just about your role as an educator, and you do so much with the blog and like explaining things to people. But then on the other hand, I wonder, and I think you must get tired of having to continually explain things to white women. And I think that's a balance that like Katie and I have come up against doing this podcast too, where we love talking to women like yourself. And a lot of the other authors that we've talked to are women of color, or other men of color or minority groups. And it's a hard line to know where we're crossing, where we want to join the conversation and become like co-conspirators and allies and work together, and where at some point it feels like you're taking advantage of that relationship again, or asking like the minority group and the oppressed group to do the work for you, to educate you, to tell you how to do things better, when it's like, you know, just figure it out. It's not that, you don't need to take advantage of people more to learn this. So how do you balance that in your role? Because obviously you love doing what you're doing, but have you felt taken advantage of, and how do you navigate that?
I don't feel taken advantage of. I do not like it when people say, when I read that, you know, Debbie Reese does tireless work, because it, I mean, I'm a human being. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that gets lost when people put you on a pedestal. Mm. I am not without fault, and I do get tired. And so I think we have to be careful of that with whoever it is that we turn to for inspiration, maybe, or guidance of any kind, is remembering that they're people and that they get tired. I don't mind emails at all, because they help me understand where we are, where my work can go, what I can help with. So I don't mind that at all. I don't like, I do get a lot of nasty email too, but I just ignore that. the thing that is always, I think, the case for me, how do I keep going, is that I have in my head, in my heart, and on my walls, depending on where I am, I have the images of Native children, and happy Native children, smiling Native children, and the firm belief, the firm thing that I hold on to, that I want them to be happy too, all the time. I don't want them to feel sad when they go to school and teachers are giving them very stereotypical kinds of things, because that happens. Mm-hmm. And they do, it does exact an emotional cost on Native kids. Their teachers are people that they trust, their parents trust, that teachers are going to help them. And here's a teacher reading aloud from Island of the Blue Dolphins or Little House on the Prairie, books that have very derogatory imagery in them. And that sort of stuff takes those kids out of that moment of enjoying the process of being part of a group and into this place of sudden dissonance. Like, what did my teacher just say? And so they're not able to stay in that moment with the rest of the class. There's a sense of isolation that happens. And then when the class moves on to do something else, whether it's something like taking a spelling test or a math test, and your head and heart are still over there like, what did my teacher say? I think when we see kids whose grades are not very good, or who are dropping out of school, I think we do have to think about the words and books we bring into the classroom and how they are impacting children who are misrepresented over and over and over again. So I keep the smiley faces, smiling photos in within reach, because that's what helps me keep going. Because that's what we need to see. Just need that.
So when you think about the future, like the next way that education could look or that could be, like, what would you hope for and imagine that in 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, maybe you imagine yourself like on a beach somewhere sipping like an ice cocktail, but if you think like, wow, where would you want your work to go next? What kind of support would you hope that you are providing for people? What would you hope to be working on in the next like 10 or 15 years? You know, what would you hope is what's drawing your attention? Because I can say right now, I wish that we weren't fighting certain fights or dealing with certain problems. There are other problems I wish we had time and effort to work on, but these are just too pressing. So what's your like dream set of problems to work on, I guess, is the question.
Okay. So part of this, the metaphor of having a mirror. When I try to tally up the number of books by Native writers, and I do that tally by their tribal nation, the name of the tribal nation, it's so small. Mm. So, the vision I would love for the future is that we would have at least one book for every federally recognized tribal nation, which is, over 550 right now. And there are some state recognized tribes. So I think there's like 200 of that. So there's a huge hole to fill. And I would like to see in 20 years, more books by writers from those nations so that kids of those nations can have that book. That's one of the things that's in Indigenous People's History of the United States, the young adult adaption that we did. When we were doing that, we went into that book thinking very carefully as two women who were raising Native children in Champaign-Urbana, where the mascot was everywhere. Mm. Our kids were dealing with stuff all the time. We wanted that book to have some representations of their nations, their identities in there. And so it's in there. So Nambe is in that book and the Muscogee Creek people are in that book because we pushed for that and we have that in there. We need more of that because, like I said, there's hundreds of nations that have no representation at all. Mm. Or what is there is not good. I was reading an article this morning. I'm going to do some professional development with librarians in next month. And so I'm rereading, looking for collection development policy guidance kind of articles about deselecting books, because the process of collection development is adding and taking away.
Yeah.
And I found one where the person was kind of focused on Native, seemed like she was going to be focused on Native content because she cited our book and she talked about settler colonialism and what that means about taking resources. And then the book list that she links to, half of the books are by white people. Mm. And they are folk kinds of things that are not even like actual Native stories. They're from those books that I was talking about earlier, those volumes that ethnographers collected. So I guess related to that is that I would like to see those books available, but I would also like to see a respect for who we are as people, because a lot of our sacred stories get turned into folklore and put on the shelf with Little Red Riding Hood. And they need to be either over there where Noah's Ark and Genesis are shelved in the library, where people will say, oh, they're over here because they're sacred stories. Mm. That means we should respect them. Or else I'd like to see all the Noah's Arks over there in the Little Red Riding Hood shelves too. So I guess what I'm saying is I would like our nationhood to be represented in children's books, you know, hundreds of books for all the Native nations. And I would like to see our stories regarded with the respect that they are due. Mm. They're just over there trivialized. And that trivialization puts them at risk for teachers using them for writing prompts. Like if the book is like How Chipmunk Got His Stripes, and that's actually a creation story that a tribal people tells as part of their origin stories, that's a sacred story. But teachers will think it's cute, and they will turn it into a writing prompt, and kids can like go make a story, ask the kids to make a story about how something happened. They wouldn't do that with Genesis. I think teachers, everybody would go, no way, we don't do that. Separate church and state. We kind of have that in our guts because it's been part of what we were raised with, all of us socialized to respect the Bible stories. I'd like to see Native stories respected too. In fact, I'd like to see them not written unless it's written by a person of that particular nation, because that particular person knows when to draw the curtains and what can be shared and what should not be shared.
Well, I hope for the day we get to that point.
Then I will be on a beach with a margarita.
Yeah, we'll join you.
That's our new campaign. Get Debbie to the beach. I mean, those are really actionable things. Like, I think the more people request from libraries and bookstores and school boards to have those materials, like an increased demand is one of the things that can drive, you know, it's one of the reasons I think editors are reading your site. You know, it's we're not huge fans of capitalism on this podcast. So I don't want capitalism to be our answer to like deep standing injustice. And yet I know when people really ask for something over and over and over again, more and more people are asking. And I think this is a place where, oh God, this is something Mandy and I wrestle with so much too. knowing that people are positioned differently in a school district, let's say. So certain parents asking for something will get responded to in a different way than other parents asking for something. And so just thinking about in whatever way we can, the agency that we have to really advocate, to ask for, to pay attention to who the authors are of the books that we're sharing, to, you know, write letters of appreciation, to counter the nasty letters you get. Like, I think there's a lot of really concrete steps that people can take now to help bring that dream to fruition. I don't think that's an unrealistic dream. You know, that feels like doable dream.
Mm-hmm. I have a good story.
Great.
That's an interesting story, because in the news in the last week has been, I think it's Studies Weekly, the Rosa Parks books that, you know, the little, it's a, yeah, right?
Yes.
Okay. I have an older story about that particular publication. Last year, I was doing webinars with teachers in California, and I was teaching them that if something belongs to you, you can write in it. And so, Little House on the Prairie, I have copies of that, and I write in that. And I said, you can teach kids to write in books because they're not sacred. You can write in books if they belong to you. And I was teaching them about past tense. So that was that one thing. The second thing was about tense. Mm-hmm. When books have past tense about Native people, they should be present tense verbs, not past tense verbs. And it so happened that one of the fourth grade teachers in that webinar, it was a six topic series, went into her classroom. And she was teaching Native kids. She's teaching Native kids in California. And she went into the classroom, and they had their Studies Weekly was there. And it was about the gold rush and California history. And they started like, okay, well, where are the Native people? Not here. And then they started, and then there was a part where there was, and they were circling the verb tense in that. And then I don't know if it was her or the kids, but there was enough upset over it that they wrote to the editors of that publication. So the editors received these letters from this classroom of fourth graders and said, they're right. And so they got back in touch with that teacher, asked if they could Zoom in, asked if they could pay for pizza to have a party where they would have the editors and the kids talking about what could be better and how it could be better. And the kids were so empowered by that. Mm-hmm. And she shared with us some photos of that gathering, because their parents, their community came to that meeting too. So you had this moment when an educational publisher has works that are presented in classrooms across the country was responding to the need when people were speaking up. Mm-hmm. This was a white teacher working with Native kids. She understood the stakes for them and she helped them to, take action. So that was a great example of teachers trying to make some interventions in the materials that come into their classrooms.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. And we will recommend and link to all of your work so that people can support it and share it with their kids' teachers, with their school boards, you know, that there's just always someone we can pass this information along to and just help keep building up that demand. Let's get those books banned. We want to get those lists filled to the brim with these amazing books so that people know more about them. So I mean, all kidding aside, really, Debbie, your blog has, I have spent so much money on books you've recommended that are just so beautiful, that have helped me, have helped my kids, have been gifts to teachers. So I just think the more we can share these beautiful books, you know, that grows that community of authors, that grows the resources that are out there. It's just really wonderful. So thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Good. We'll be in touch.
Thank you.